From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Craig Cohen, sitting in for David Inge this hour. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry, and our producer is Harriet Williamson. In this hour of the program, we will welcome your questions about the care and maintenance of your home for Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this once a month and invite your questions on everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements. Just about anything that goes into the single-family home. If you're thinking about making some changes or something needs to be repaired, we welcome your phone call. And here's how you do it. You call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's WILL-TALK at illinois.edu. E-D-U. And at this time, we welcome in Scott Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Morning. Thank you for letting me come in.
Absolutely. I bet you were expecting David to be sitting here.
No, actually, I was given a heads up that he would not be here today.
Well, despite that, despite the fact that I am here, we'll do the best we can.
Oh, I'm sure our listeners will help out just as much as possible.
All right. Well, the first thought that I had was that summer arrives this week. So it makes sense to maybe talk a little bit about some summertime tips in terms of home maintenance. What do you recommend? What are things that you should always do every summer?
Well, okay, this one's going to be more for some of the older homes. When you start opening your screens, or open your windows and use the screens a lot, let the quote-unquote fresh air in. Make sure that there's a drain hole at the bottom of the screen. If water blows in through the bottom of the screen and you've got the screen caulked at the bottom or sealed at the bottom, mm-hmm. that water will sit on your windowsill and tend to peel the paint or even rot the windowsill. So when you look out your screen, look at the bottom of it. There should be a couple of small holes or a slot or something to allow any water to run out to prevent any accumulation. I know a lot of times in the wintertime, somebody gets a little over energetic and they start caulking and sealing everything. And if that storm window frame gets sealed at the bottom, we can get that thing blocked up. So any water coming through that screen sits in that windowsill. And next thing you know, we end up peeling paint and damaging that wood sill.
Of course, during the summer, we deal with extreme temperatures. It gets extremely warm. And I imagine going from the extreme cold of winter, the extreme heat of summer, things happen to your home, expansion and contraction and that sort of thing. What do you need to do along those lines?
Actually, the heat isn't the big issue. It's the humidity. When the wintertime, when things dry out, they tend to shrink. You end up with some more cracks. In the summertime, when the moisture levels start coming back up, the house starts to actually swell. Wood frame houses breathe. They move up and down between winter and summer, and so there's always some movement. So to find a couple little cracks here and there usually aren't a big issue, but most of the time that cracking occurs in the wintertime, not into the summertime.
We'll come back to some more tips, but again, I want to remind our listeners that in this hour of the program, we're welcoming your questions about the care and maintenance of your home for Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this once a month, inviting your questions on everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements, pretty much anything that goes into the single-family home. If you want to make some changes or maybe there's something you need to get repaired, we welcome your phone calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And you can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll take our first call this morning from Robinson, Illinois, line one. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I have a gas furnace with propane gas tank in the back, and I need to replace it. And I was wondering if you recommend a heat pump or a high-energy efficient furnace and air conditioning unit to replace the whole unit that I have now.
Well, a lot of that's going to depend on your power supplier. Your heat pumps, they are electric. If the provider you have in your area gives you a break on the heat pump, that may be definitely something you want to consider, is switching out and putting in a heat pump. Oftentimes, particularly in rural areas, there'll be electric co-ops and such, and they will give you price breaks if you are all electric or if you have an electric heating system or a heating system that can be a heating and cooling system that can be changed, turned on and off at peak power periods. So I would check with your power provider and see if there's any incentives to want to go to an all-electric system such as a heat pump. The second thing was, okay, what kind of a heat pump should we put in? Should we put in a air-to-air heat pump, or should we put in a water, groundwater type heat pump, one where they actually drill a well and they sink a line down into the well and use the ground temperature as your quote-unquote heat source?
That's a geothermal one, right, what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah,
that means digging up quite a bit of the yard, right?
And depends on how they do it. If they run a flat one, or sometimes they'll dig a straight down well. They'll just come out there with a truck and drill a hole and run a loop down into the ground. So
well,
there's
my
a couple.
My plumber was recommending electric, I guess it is, with a backup propane for when it gets too cold, so that it has a fuel to turn to when it doesn't work.
Right, because a heat pump works well except for when the temperature drops below about 25 degrees outside. Once it's below 25 outside, there's not a lot of heat to draw from, and so then a backup system does help. And they are, I'm going to say, a little bit more expensive to operate than what we have in this area, which is natural gas. But if you can get some incentive from your power company, it could be a very viable alternative. So it is something to check into in your area.
Okay, because I'm further south in Champaign, 2 hours south.
Right.
And so it's warmer here, but I have propane, not natural gas, so the propane's pretty expensive.
Exactly. That's why I say it's worth checking in with your provider on that to make sure. Now, I will say that the heat pump oftentimes delivers a less comfortable heat. Yes, a heat pump blows a lot of warm air. Instead of a little bit of hot air, it blows a lot of warm air. The heat pump will kick on and the fan will start blowing somewhere in the 100 to 110 degree range rather than your propane system right now, which blows 120, 130 degree air. So particularly for the elderly or really young folks, you can really feel a kind of almost a draft. So hopefully you have a good location on your heat ducts and things like that, because that heat pump does not have as big a temperature drop. If you've got it, let's say you're keeping the house at 65 degrees, the temperature coming out at 95 or 100 degrees may almost feel drafty.
Okay.
Now, when it does drop down, of course, when it's really cold outside, then it drops down unless your propane system can kick back on.
Okay.
And that's one of the advantages of the geothermal is that it you can usually get a little bit more temperature drop out of it because it's a little more consistent.
Okay.
And anytime you go with just a full propane, then yes, you'll go right back up to where you're 120, 130, and you can put your feet over the register and they feel nice and warm.
Right. Okay.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
I have recently gone from geothermal to natural gas. I had geothermal for about a decade elsewhere in the country. And I found that it was complicated at times trying to get just the temperature right in the house. But the interesting thing is switching to natural gas, I feel like it's even more complicated now. But it's because of what I got used to. You know, I got used to geothermal, and I got used to this idea of, okay, I need to adjust the thermostat a certain way, and I know this is how long it'll take for everything to warm up or cool down or whatever the situation was. Now I have no idea what I'm doing anymore. And I seem to be going
usually,
wild swings from one to the other. It's
yeah,
either
usually the natural
frigid
gas
or,
will react a little bit faster
yeah.
than what your geothermal or your
yeah.
heat pump will.
Yeah. Let's go next to line two. Caller in Paris, Illinois. Good morning.
Hello there. I have two questions. One of them is about I watched them put on a metal roof, and it looked very good to me. What do you think about metal roofs as opposed to the ones we usually have?
Well, a metal roof is going to be more expensive to start with.
It is more expensive?
Generally speaking, the original roof is a lot more expensive than what an asphalt shingle. Dollar for dollar, the asphalt shingle is about the most economical
yeah.
long life you can get. The steel is a little bit more expensive, but does last longer.
There,
I've got to do some research on that. Yours is not the first time this question has come up, and I can't give you a definite answer. The only thing I am concerned with on a metal roof is condensation. There were some houses built in the Champaign-Urbana area that I've seen that had gutters inside the attic area, because the metal roof, any moisture or humidity in the house tends to go up through the attic area, and that metal roof is cold enough we get condensation on it, and it gets frost and sometimes enough to actually have water running off of it. So I'm not sure what they're doing about a vapor barrier between the living space and the steel. if you don't have some type of very, very good vapor barrier, you could have moisture problems on that steel roof.
What about rust? Moisture. Would that be a problem?
The rust, you're not going to get.
All right. Well, what about, now they tell me on this roof that they were putting on that they had a ridge roof aeration system. It's what they put on.
Right. They put a vent system on it to help ventilate any air, but that doesn't necessarily...
To ventilate that attic area. What about that? Wouldn't that take care of it, maybe?
Well, that will help, yes. But if you were to have a wet basement or wet crawl space issue, then that may not be enough ventilation to take all the humidity out of there.
Oh.
But like I say, I'm not going to say no because it is a good long-lasting roof. I'm just trying to figure out how they're getting around this this moisture issue on the new construction.
Yeah, not only is it a good idea, but it's also fireproof.
Yes, it is.
And
they do.
It will lower your insurance.
I'm not sure I would use that as a determining factor because I'm not sure it's going to lower it enough to make it feasible on the price cost. But
yeah, okay.
And the steel roof is a powder coated roof, so it is a very long life and doesn't rust and doesn't need paint and doesn't need maintenance. Mm-hmm. But I do worry about the humidity, so that's something I'll do some checking into that, see what I can find out for us.
Okay. My other question is about windows. I have a 50-year-old house. Maybe it's a little older now, and I have trouble with the windows, open and closing the windows in the winter. You know.
Mm-hmm.
When the winter starts, locking it. What is there something? Do I have to have this worked on by someone?
My guess is that over the time the windows have been painted several times, and the paint is making them sticky and difficult to operate.
So there's no paint involved. It's just won't close or open. I don't know if it's swollen or the ropes don't work. I'm not sure what. What is your recommendation for what can I do about it? Because I would like to be able to open them.
Mm-hmm.
I have about two windows now that are very hard to open and close.
You should be able to get a carpenter to come in there with just a very little effort. He should be able to sand them down and make them very easy to open.
Oh, okay. I never thought about that.
Yeah, the
carpenter. Okay.
Yeah, that style of window is pretty easy to take out of the sash. You pull the stop trim out on the front, and the whole window comes out, and you can just sand
the edges.
These
are the ones with the ropes, you know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
By the cords, you slide them up and down.
Right.
And they have this lock that you turn up at the top.
Right. Yeah, those will come out fairly easily. The other thing to do is to have them reworked and put in new sash. Weather strippings and get rid of that rope, because where that rope goes in and out and that weight is inside the window, there is a hollow spot, and that spot is not insulated. So if you were to change over to a different weather stripping system and glide system for those windows, you could actually insulate that big opening and make the windows a little bit more efficient without having to replace the windows.
Well, thank you very much for that call. And we started to talk briefly. I asked the question about whether or not with a metal roof you have any concern about rust developing if you have moisture around it a lot. Is that an issue?
Yeah, no. The new metal roofing is has a powder-coated finish, basically a plastic finish that's baked on. So it's quite durable.
Okay. Let's go next to line 4 in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm currently evaluating two bids to have cellulose blown-in insulation put into... put into the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And my roof it has a ridge vent. It has vents on the south and north walls. There is no soffit vent or eave vent. Now, one of the contractors is saying that you should still put an air chute. The other one's saying there's no point if you don't have any soffit or eave vent. And the second contractor, who thinks they shouldn't put in air chutes, is also saying that it's okay to use a air fan, whereas the first one said don't use a fan. So I was wondering if you could address that.
Well, first of all, if you don't have any soffit ventilation, it wouldn't be a bad idea to put in some type of soffit ventilation. Is there a soffit on the house, or is it designed so there is no overhang?
There is, yeah, you could put them in.
Well, that would be my recommendation, because the best way to do attic ventilation is by convection. When the sun hits the roofing surface and the attic temperature goes up, the air, hot air rises and tries to go out through the upper vents, ridge vents or button vents or whatever. However, in order for it to go up and out, there has to be an air source for fresh air to come back in. It can't pull a vacuum on the attic area. So ideally, the best place to pull it is from that soffit area. So to put in the air chutes and put in, even if you're only going to put like four on a side of the house or something, four on each side, it doesn't take a lot of ventilation in the soffit area to get good ventilation in the attic because of the natural convection. The air will actually draw itself up through there. I do not feel that if there are no vents in the soffit, then the air chutes are going to do very little. Now, I will admit that most of the time the soffit area is not airtight. In other words, when they put in the soffit coverings and such, it's not caulked in place, so there are gaps, so there's always going to be some air. But I don't know if it's adequate enough that you would need to put in your air chutes. But from a ventilation standpoint, I'd put in the air chutes and probably put in a couple of vents into the soffit. Just cut some holes and put a grill over the top of it, and help that natural convection get that heat out of the attic. The power vent fans, that's one of those things where if you don't have adequate ventilation, then you can put that in there, and it will help, but it does cost money to run, electricity to run. Usually about every 3 or 4 years you end up replacing one of the fans, so they are a little more expensive to do. When cutting holes in the soffit and putting grills on it is a one-time cost and works forever.
Okay. So there's no problem, though, that you see with running a fan, though?
No problem, just an expense.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for that phone call. This is Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Craig Cohen, sitting in for David Inge this hour. My guest is Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service. He joins us every month to field your home care questions about everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements, pretty much anything that goes into the single-family home. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go next to line one in Atwood. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a house built in 64 with a vent ridge and then some kind of holes down on the soffit, and it always, I could go up there in the summer and feel air movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently had a new roof put on, and I told the contractor, you know, that I wanted that, and so he put in what he figured was better, but it looks like plastic chore girl.
Right.
And there's just no air movement up there. I opened the attic door, and there's still no air movement. You got any idea what my son and I, we went on top of the roof and looked, and you know, we can see the plastic chore girl and from both the outside and the inside, but the air isn't moving. You got any idea what's wrong?
Well, a lot of times, depending on the brand of the roof vent, in order to reduce the chances of rain or snow blowing in through the vent, they put in the mesh in there, and that does reduce some of the air movement. It doesn't mean you have no air movement. I would be checking.
It was up to the thermometer I put up went up to 110, and that's as high as the thermometer went. Boy, we just couldn't feel anything.
It is not uncommon for attic temperatures to be in the 130, 140 degree range. You don't want them any higher than about 145 or 150. You start getting some damage to the shingles. Hmm. But it is really not uncommon for attic temperatures to get up in that range. Yeah. Obviously, it would be nice if we could keep them around 125 to 130, but that's kind of hard to do. You almost need an excessive amount of ventilation, which next thing you know, if you ventilate it too much, you start getting water in as well, so you end up with leaks.
That plastic chore girl probably is all right then?
As long as your attic temperatures are not exceeding the 145 degree mark, you're probably okay. You might want to get a different style of thermometer that goes a little bit higher and keep an eye on it.
Okay.
Also, you can check for that air movement. Instead of checking it up in the attic, going up there and feeling if it's moving there, put your hand in front of one of the soffit vents and see if you can feel it drawing air in. Or take a candle and blow it out and let a little smoke around the bottom of the soffit and see if it isn't drawn into that soffit vent. Now, I'll think you're probably actually are moving a little bit of air. It's just not moving as much as what you were used to.
Well, the old metal ones, boy, you could just feel air move. But.
Yeah, the problem we have with those is it could also get snow blowing in there, and people would end up with water stains on the roof. Could you end up with, you know, 4 or 5 foot diameter circle of snow where the wind managed to blow it in there, and then when it melted, it got the insulation wet? And
well, I've had two. This is the third roof I put on. The first one ever worked, worked perfect. Mm-hmm. And the second one, boy, it put snow in like mad, and we noticed that the vents were in different from the first one. And so I got the vent bent like the first one, and then that worked perfect. But then this last contractor, he put in this plastic stuff.
Yeah, and the plastic ones generally work, but I do know that there are a couple of them that almost work too well. If you get block it up enough, then you don't get the airflow through it. So, like I said, get something like a candle or a smoke stick, something that you can put down there at one of your soffit vents and see if it isn't drawing some air in there. I think you'll find that it probably is.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that call. Spent a lot of time in this first half hour talking about attics. What about basements? What do you need to do to keep your basement secure and humming along during the summer?
Well, basements don't do much. Basements, everything you want to do is on the outside. In other words, a sump pump is a solution to a symptom, not a solution to a problem. If you've got water in the basement, the problem isn't how do I pump it out. The problem is how do we keep it getting there in the first place.
Yeah.
So Dave and I talk on a regular basis about cleaning gutters and walking around the outside, making sure downspouts extended out. Also some grading around the house. Make sure that the yard slopes away from the house, particularly in the first 2 to 3 feet right next to the foundation. Get a good slope to where effectively the house is on a hill and the water wants to run away. And that's what helps keep your basement dry, or drier anyway. The other thing you could do if you've got a basement house and it feels a little damp is to run a dehumidifier. An air conditioning system is a great dehumidifier, but on days that we've had here lately where in the evenings it drops down to 65 or 70, the air conditioner is not running, so you're not taking moisture out of the house, but you're still getting moisture in the house. Cooking, cleaning, showering, talking, laundry, things like that are still putting moisture into the house, but none of it is leaving because we're not running the air conditioner. So putting in a dehumidifier will help the moisture levels in the basement, help reduce condensation problems, and actually make the house more comfortable by keeping it a little bit drier in the summertime.
We are due to take a short break. We'll have more of your phone calls and emails for Scott Spies in just a minute. It's our monthly home care show on Focus. And in
support for...
Sorry, go ahead. All right, in the second hour of Focus this morning, we'll have a conversation that... David Inge conducted with William Adler about Joe Hill, the songwriter who became an American labor icon. It's the subject of Adler's book, The Man Who Never Died. That's in the second hour of Focus this morning. Do we have something we need to air? Oh, okay. All right. Wasn't sure what was going on, but all right. I guess we carry on. Welcome back to Focus, such as it is, on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Craig Cohen in this hour for David Inge. Typically on the third Monday of each month, we open up the phones to give you a chance to ask any and all questions that you might have about the care and maintenance of your home for Scott Spies of the Spies Home Inspection Service. Whether you're thinking of making some changes to your home or something needs to be repaired, you are welcome to call. The phone number is 333-9455, or you can call us toll-free from outside the Champaign-Urbana area at 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have a question via email. Person asks, I have an old house with peeling paint on the wood siding, and I would like to repaint it myself. Can you suggest methods and products?
Well, I try not to get into products because there are so many of them out there and so many different types. But as far as paint peeling, there's usually two primary causes for paint to peel. One would be too many layers of paint. If you look at the paint and it has extensive cracking perpendicular to the wood grain, so if you've got horizontal siding, if you've got a bunch of vertical cracks, usually about a quarter of an inch apart or so, that tells me you've got too many layers of paint. Paint, when you apply it, has some elasticity or some stretch to it. And when the wood expands and contracts with temperature and humidity changes, that paint then stretches with it. Once you get that paint film up to about 35 thousandths of an inch, it loses a lot of that elasticity, a lot of that stretch. So now when the wood goes to expand, the paint ends up pulling itself apart or cracking. And that type of cracking means that we need to scrape all the old paint off the wood. So if you've got an older home and it's been painted multiple times, that's usually what we run into, and that is a chore, trying to get all the old paint loose, particularly since there's a good chance that some of the base layers are lead, so you want to make sure you use proper techniques for sanding or scraping. No heat involved, because if there's lead-based paints, it puts off lead fumes, things like that. So that's when it gets a little tricky. The other type of peeling is if you end up with, like, large panels, kind of, you know, like 3 or 4 inch diameter pieces of paint just coming off. That is usually due to a moisture peel. Somewhere in the house we've got too much humidity or moisture, condensation on the back of the siding, or roof leak, things like that, lack of ventilation. Something is creating a water problem in the house. And now moisture peel, you can scrape it down, but unfortunately, as soon as you paint, it still seals moisture back in there, and you can end up with the peeling happening again. So you actually have to trace down the moisture problem. Once you scrape the paint down to bare wood, it helps to, I'll call, touch sanding. Basically, lightly sanding the wood just within an hour or so of putting a primer coat on it. You should prime any bare exposed wood, but the wood, if it's been exposed for any length of time, will have some dead wood cells from UV deterioration, sunlight. And so in order to make sure your paint seals to the wood properly, you really need to sand off the top layer of wood cells just prior to putting your primer on there and sealing that the wood. Otherwise, you're likely to get more peeling.
We have another email from Mike. He asks, to follow up on your comments regarding dehumidifiers, is there a particular kind that's best for a crawl space?
Well, a dehumidifier, really, there's no particular brand, no particular type. If you've got an exceptionally large area that you want to dehumidify, you may need to get a little bit bigger one. Most of the time, dehumidifiers are rated in how many quarts of water they will hold. I like to set up a dehumidifier so that it doesn't hold any water. You put a hose on it and run it to either a sump pump or to a floor drain, something that drains out, even a sanitary drain, to where when it runs, it starts getting collecting water, it ends up draining out. So you don't actually collect any water, so you don't have to remember to empty the thing. If you have to empty it, chances are you forget it. It fills up. It automatically shuts itself off. Then it doesn't run for 2 or 3 days till you slap yourself in the forehead and go, oh, I forgot to empty the dehumidifier, and it's full of water. So it hasn't worked for 2 days. So I do like to set them up to make sure that they have some type of hose to drain them and run them to, like, say, a sump pump if it's in a crawl space or basement. A floor drain works well. Dehumidifiers probably don't need to be in the crawl space. When you end up drawing moisture out with a dehumidifier, you create a low vapor pressure, a low vapor area. And since water vapor, once water is evaporated, it becomes a vapor. Since vapor moves by vapor pressure and not airflow, if you create a low vapor pressure anywhere in the house, the rest of the house is relatively high. The high vapor pressure areas will move towards the low vapor pressure. So what happens is you put in a dehumidifier, let's say instead of a crawl space, you put it in a laundry room, you mount it on a shelf, you drain the hose into where the laundry drain is. That area, that dehumidifier in the laundry room will actually help dehumidify the crawl space, the attic, the rooms at the other end of the house. That vapor will move through just about everything except a vapor barrier, a sheet of plastic. So it moves through walls, floors, doors, building materials in general. If you run a humidifier, say a vaporizer in a small child's room, 20 to 30 minutes after you turn that vaporizer off, the moisture level in that room and the one, say, at the far end of the house is probably going to be pretty close to the same, because that moisture, the high vapor pressure in that child's room, ends up moving through the floors and the doors and the walls and the carpet and dissipates throughout the house, trying to equalize the vapor pressure in the house. So you don't necessarily need to put the dehumidifier in a crawl space. A basement's nice because it's out of the way. You don't usually hear it. That's where most of the drains are, floor drains and such. But it does not hurt to build a shelf in the laundry room, set it up on a shelf. There's no reason why it can't be set up high so that you can get a gravity drain into the laundry drain. So placement of the dehumidifier is not that critical, as long as we've got a good drain to it. Sizing and brands, there's really not that critical. They all do about the same thing. It's a compressor. It's basically a small air conditioner system without a fan.
You mentioned the laundry room. What sort of maintenance needs to be done in a laundry room on a regular basis? Anything other than just sort of keeping track, make sure the hoses don't fall apart?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of maintenance in there. If the laundry room's on a second floor, I like to recommend a drain catch pan underneath the laundry system, so if something goes wrong, it catches it before it leaks into the room below it. Of course, we have to make sure our dryer vent is clear. If you've got a gas dryer, you should have a metal duct, not a plastic duct. Even most of the new electric dryers get hot enough to where we're recommending metal piping instead of plastic piping for it, so that we'd reduce the chances of damaging the plastic piping with excessive heat.
How often do you need to clear out those ducts?
Kind of depends on how good you are at cleaning out your lint screen on your dryer. If you do as intended, which is to clear out the vent every time, then you have very little lint get past the trap, then the piping stays clear. If you tend to forget once in a while and it tends to overflow the vent, you go to pull out the screen and it's completely blocked, well, that means a lot of it probably got past it, went out the into the hose, and so now the hose will need to be cleaned out.
Yeah, but if you don't clean the lint remover, eventually you get this nice pillowy kind of blanket of a little, you know, you can
when that collects out in the hose, then it becomes a fire issue.
That's true. let's take another call. We have line one from Champaign. Good morning. Welcome to Focus.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question about installing a backflow preventer. I have a in-ground sprinkling system that I couldn't feed with solid piping directly, so I'm having to run a supply out through the wall where our garden hose also comes out, the same outlet, and then I'll have to do some temporary piping across a walk. That's not the part I'm asking about, really. But I need to put in a backflow preventer, and I kind of checked into it a little. I know some of them are real expensive, a couple $100s. They're all brass and everything. I think there are some maybe that are less expensive that would do the job where, again, you're attaching a temporary PVC or whatever from an external line down to the line that feeds the in-ground irrigation system. That's one question about the two types, expensive or not expensive. The other one is, how about a shutoff that you can drain with a drain cock in it or whatever you call that? Would that be ahead of the backflow preventer or after it?
Okay, the backflow preventer, yes, there are several different types, and basically the more expensive ones are intended to be a little bit more durable, usually commercial operation. For what you're doing, I would say probably the inexpensive one would work fairly well, since we're not talking about something that is running day in, day out. You're looking at a sprinkler system that runs part of the season and only occasionally at that. So I would say from an operational standpoint, the most expensive ones, while would be nice, would not necessarily be what needed to be put in. And yes, I do recommend a shutoff valve and a drain cock and or fitting where you can hook up an air hose to where in the wintertime we can actually blow out the system and get any water out of the sprinkler system so we don't have freezing problems. And that would be on the back side, or on the front side, or the after the backflow preventer.
So, we're sort of talking about two different things there. One would be a shutoff outside, I guess, where you hook up to your in-ground system. I'm talking about one that would be inside to allow, again, to in the winter to drain just that line that runs from the black backflow preventer to the outside of the house.
Now, you're putting your backflow preventer outdoors or indoors?
Well, I was thinking of putting it indoors. I guess that's part of the question.
Yeah, if the backflow preventer is indoors, then there's no point in putting a shutoff valve between it and the main water source. You can put your drain valve and your shutoff valve after the backflow preventer.
Okay. All right. Great. That's what I wanted to know.
As long as it's located indoors, you can put it afterwards. If the backflow preventer gets put outdoors, then of course we have to drain it from the backside or from the inside to prevent freezing.
Gotcha.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. You're listening to Focus on Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen in for David Inge this hour. And in this hour of the program, we're welcoming your questions about the care and maintenance of your home. For Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, we do this every month. We invite your questions on everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements, pretty much anything that goes into the single-family home. So whether you're thinking about making some changes or you need something repaired, we welcome your phone calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's WILL-TALK@illinois.edu. All right, so we started the hour talking a little bit about some summertime tips, and we've gone through a few different things. What else do you have for us? What are some things that you should do absolutely every summer?
Well, actually, summer, springtime, check for any bushes, trees that have grown. They get that big sudden growth spurt in the springtime. The next thing you know, they're rubbing up against the siding or rubbing up against the shingles, and you can create premature wear or damage to the house by all these brush, all the brush and trees rubbing up against things. So this is about the time of year when the sudden growth spurt is over. The trees have thrown out their sprouts, and the bushes have gotten, always have to trim right around Memorial Day anyway. Now's the time to go out there and trim and make sure. My rule of thumb is anything on the roof, if you're standing on the roof and you can reach it, is too close. And around the siding, you really need to be able to walk between shrubs and the siding in order to get proper airflow to make sure we don't get water damage, mold and mildew, things like that on the siding. You want to have a little bit of a gap back in there. And that's not always possible, but try and keep it cut back to where things are not actually touching the siding. That will help the exterior of your house last a lot longer.
Well, lightning strikes. You want to make sure that, tree branches aren't so close to the house that, if lightning strikes, the branch comes down and, hits your house.
Well, I kind of like the branches overhanging the house somewhat, because in this area where we have a lot of cooling days, it gets nice and warm. The house, you end up running the air conditioning a lot. As much shade as you can get on the house or on the roof is going to reduce your cooling more than just about anything else. So I don't like to get them cut back too far if it's the only shade you've got. But, if you've got large overhead branches, storms in central Illinois are not uncommon, so it's something to keep in mind.
So, hot day. I'll risk it. If there's lightning, so be it. we've talked about a great deal of the interior of the house, but I imagine something else that comes up in the summertime is, what do you do about your decks, your patios, your balconies? What do you do to keep those clean? When's a good time to seal the deck?
When it's not raining.
Okay, fair enough.
You want to make sure it's dry. Yes, your pressure-treated lumber that we make most of our exterior decking and balconies and such from doesn't deteriorate with water damage, but it will still deteriorate with UV or sunlight damage. There are several products on the market. Most of them are clear that you can put over the top of whatever pressure-treated lumber you've got, and that will give it some UV protection. The sunlight will cause cracking, splitting of the boards, make them a rough texture. So while your deck may not rot on you because it's pressure-treated, it sure gets ugly awful quick. The best thing to do would be to use one of the deck washes. They actually make, it's a mild solution of oxalic acid and other things that help bring the new look back to the deck, take the graying out of it, make the deck look a little bit newer, and then put a clear finish over the top of that. And most of those can be applied to you either with a roller or with a general garden sprayer. Not too hard to do. You just need to make sure that you pick one of the 3 days in a row that we have that doesn't decide to start raining in the middle of things.
Yeah, good luck. All right, so this is also the time of year when a lot of people really dig into some more serious remodeling projects indoors. Maybe they're remodeling a bathroom or a kitchen. What mistake would you say people tend to make most often as they commence with that sort of remodeling?
Oh, there's no one thing that really jumps out to mind. You say extensive. One of the problems we run into is that the lumber we're using nowadays when we're building is second and third generation growth lumber. It's farm-raised lumber. That lumber tends to expand and contract more with humidity changes. When you buy lumber from the lumber store, it by federal standard is dried down to 19% moisture content. After it's been in the house for the first year or two, it tends to dry down to about a 10% moisture content. When it does, it loses 50% of the water that was in it when you bought it. It's going to shrink. You buy a nice straight board. You go down there and you go through the pallet of boards and you find every straight 2x4 and you bring them home. And if you wait about 3 days before doing anything with it, next thing you know, half of them have got a corkscrew to them. As that lumber dries, this newer lumber, younger lumber dries, it tends to move on you. So you have to take into account some shrinkage. You try and level out a floor. Well, a floor that's level when the wood is green is not going to be level when the wood dries out. So you actually have to build the new floor slightly higher than the old floor and then wait for it to shrink up. And that, depending on what you're using for lumber, it could be as much as a quarter of an inch.
How do you calculate that? How do you know how much it's likely to shrink?
That is a very tough question, and it's more of a feel, so you want to find somebody that's pretty experienced in it. A 2x10 can shrink 3/8 of an inch. A 2x8 will shrink about a quarter of an inch. Once you get down to 2x6 and 2x4, it's a little bit less than that. It's just rules of thumb. If you've got a carpenter that knows what's going on, usually you're in pretty good shape. But it's very interesting after you build something, a new addition or remodel something, put in a new wall. It's not uncommon next year to find cracks where in the corners or movement because the wood that was used has now dried out and created a gap. Matter of fact, entire new houses. When you buy a new house, it comes with a one-year warranty. That one-year warranty includes coming back and filling nail pops, which are not actually the nail coming out, but the wood shrinking away from the head of the nail, and small cracks and such in the drywall, because anytime we build a home, that's going to happen. So that'll happen on your remodel projects as well.
So 8x10 isn't really necessarily 8x10, and that's a mistake people make.
It is when it's cut right out of the – when it's green out of the lumber yard, theoretically it's 8x10. As soon as it goes to the dryer, it comes out a lot smaller than that.
Let's take another call. Caller on line 4 from Flora, Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning. I am installing a aluminum fence, but it's going to look like a wrought iron with the post, the vertical post, and then a horizontal one on the bottom. How far is that bottom rail supposed to be from the ground?
There's no set requirement for something like that. I'm going to guess that the spacing is such that rabbits can get through anyway, so it's not a big issue as far as keeping things out. I would like to see it high enough to where it doesn't get damaged too heavily by lawnmowers. Since it is a decorative, it's more to keep people from nilly-willy wandering around on the property. You can set up high enough to where a weed whacker or a lawnmower can try and get under the edge of it. You set it down too low, and next thing you know, somebody's going to be running up against there with the riding mower or whacking the heck out of it with their little nylon weed whacker, nylon string trimmer, and damage your fencing. So keeping it up a little bit higher, just so you basically mow around it, would be the only consideration I would have.
About 3 inches, would that be enough?
That's minimum for a lawnmower. So 3 to 4 inches would be probably recommended and probably look better. From a aesthetic value, if you've got 8 inches or 6 inches between each post or 4 inches between each post, that's probably about the same distance you want to have from the horizontal bar to the ground as well, just so that everything looks evenly spaced.
Okay. And then for a placement, they can go gradually down or up, and it's no more than 3 inches, right?
It all depends. Yeah, it depends on how long a piece you're using. But yes, you can get some flex out of them and get them to move a little bit.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Hope that helps.
Thanks very much for the call. We have a little less than 10 minutes left in today's program, and there is still time for you to take part in the conversation here on Focus. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. My guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. All right, so you said earlier that there aren't maybe any really big mistakes that people make when they're doing remodeling, but there are some small mistakes, and you mentioned one. Are there others that you tend to come across?
Usually it's the estimation of how much it's going to cost.
They all overestimate, right? No.
Yeah, usually you take your original estimate and double it and then add 10%.
Wow.
It's amazing how quick the cost can go up, and it's something to keep in mind. I try and stay away from trendy or fad type things because it's, you watch a little too much of the HGTV and you want to paint everything a dark color. And the next time somebody comes in there, they can't get that dark color off. So they end up repainting with like 6-7 coats of paint to get it back to a neutral color. So, yeah, when you're doing a lot of interior remodeling, try and stay away from too many of the elite trends, because it's amazing how fast your house goes out of style when you do something like that.
One of the trends, I guess, these days is to really deck out a kitchen, you know, with these monster ovens and refrigerators and islands. People are insane about if they remodel a kitchen, they has to have an island in the middle of it. Why?
Well, it makes for good counter space. Let's face it, your normal kitchen has cabinets over the counter space in a lot of areas, so it's not really easy to work over. It doesn't give you a lot of depth as far as how many items you can stack on there and how much work you can do. It's a whole lot easier to take the kids and go make cookies if they can be on one side and you can be on the other side. So that island is helpful for family cooking activities, things like that.
Have there ever been any kind of remodels that you've looked at, either been a part of putting together, or you look at the plans and you just think to yourself, oh, good grief.
Well, on kitchens, you do have to work around what we'll call the workspace. There's a basically a little triangle that you're going to be working in. It's going to include the sink, the refrigerator, and the stove. Those are the areas you're going to be at the most. There really should be a little bit of counter space between any of the and all of the above, so you can, from the sink, you can set something on a counter. From the stove, if something needs to be come off, you can set it on something. The refrigerator, you take something out. Well, let's say the gallon of milk is back behind the orange juice. You want to be able to set the orange juice down somewhere nearby so you can reach back there and grab the milk, because, of course, the other hand is always busy doing something. So kitchens are interesting for planning as far as ease of use and workspace.
I guess what I'm asking is there are practical considerations, but then there are designs, I'm sure, that are quite impractical. And there have to be moments where you say, well, what were they thinking? Why do they want to do it this way?
Yes. I have seen some that were quite interesting that had me scratching my head. And a lot of times they're more show pieces than they are functional pieces. And the person actually doesn't spend a lot of time in that area or that room. But it looks really good and it would make a magazine cover, but wouldn't necessarily be functional as far as a good living space.
I have another question. It's just a general curiosity for you, which we'll get to right after one more phone call. I think we have time for line one in Urbana. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Our older home has half-round gutters and round downspouts. They're galvanized, and they've been there with the life of the house. They need to be replaced. And I've just not been able to find a supplier and installer for that in our community. I have galvanized now, and I would also be interested in what's your prediction of how long it might last. I see on the web that aluminum is also possible, and if I rob a bank, I could get copper.
That's about right. Well, first of all, why is it you're wanting to stick with the half round?
Because it looks good on the house.
A half round has about half the capacity of a standard 4-inch gutter, so they overflow a lot more often. So you're going for an aesthetic appeal only then?
That's correct.
Okay. In that particular case, yeah, the aluminum ones are probably going to be the most economical and probably the most durable. The steel ones, well, with galvanized, last a while, but steel tends to, first of all, you have to put it up in sections, so you end up with joints, and the more joints you have, the more chances of leaks. Most of the time, the aluminum ones, a guy comes out with a machine, and they pretty much cut them to length. So if you need a 40-foot piece, you end up with a one-piece gutter 40 feet long. Whereas the steel ones, you'll end up buying in 8 or 10 foot sections, and you end up with 4 or 5 joints in there. And the next time you go out there, of course, one of the joints is going to be directly over the top of the door. So when you walk out, it drips right on top of your head.
Yeah.
A little bit of careful planning there, just in case you didn't catch that. Make sure you get a solid piece over the top of windows and doors, if possible, and plan where the joints are going to be. You may have to cut them a little bit, but plan where the joints are going to be so you don't end up with leaks in inopportune places such as that. I don't know of anybody that's doing the half round in with gutter machines these days, so I don't know if you'd have to order it in sections or if you could have somebody custom make them. Most of the time, the half round ones we don't use anymore just because they don't have the capacity. They do tend to overflow, and they do not mount as easily. You end up having to strap them to the house because there's no flat surface to nail to fascias and things like that. So I would have
to say, I'm seeing the house right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and usually the straps to the house aren't as stable. They tend to pull down with ice and things. Steel ones, of course, would be, if you've got a lot of trees in the area and you've got a lot of ice, the steel ones are going to be more durable. The aluminum ones, you're not going to have to paint as often, because even galvanized doesn't hold paint where the darn it tends to peel if you do paint it. So from a maintenance standpoint, I would say aluminum, but from a durability standpoint, you might look into the steel.
Right, but still, you run a blank on who might be able to...
Yeah, that one I don't know.
Okay, well, thanks for the advice on the material, though.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much for that call. It looks like we do just have a minute or two left, so perfect timing for this, and this is an odd question. I'm telling you up front, but... I'm always curious when it comes to anybody that I talk with from any walk of life, how much they take their job home with them. And when it comes to something like home maintenance and home repair, there's always something to do in your own home. But how much are you of the attitude of, boy, I love my job so much that when I get home, I love to work on the house, or is it the opposite?
Okay, you just described my father. yes, Hank used to do this show,
yep,
and
was on
with the
him
university. Yeah, was with the University Small Homes Council, and yes, he loves the whole home maintenance and anything to do with construction. And when he's at home, he's on the computer looking at different building materials and such. Of course, I grew up with all this. I'm not quite into the home maintenance. I know exactly what's wrong with my house, and I know just how serious it is if I don't do anything about it. So I kind of tend to procrastinate on getting things done because I know, if I wait a little bit longer, it's not going to hurt anything. So, yeah, I would have to say that the home maintenance issue is not my primary concern.
It's not that many mice coming in the door. It's fine. Oh, that's not that big a hole.
But the good news, the lucky part, I guess, is I have the knowledge base such that when something gets to the point where it needs to be done, I can take care of it quickly.
So once the water's up to your knees, it's time to...
Nah, we know where to keep the water from getting in.
Well, we have come to the end of our time for this hour. Before we go, thanks to our guest, Scott Spies, home inspector from Spies Home Inspection Service. Scott, thanks as always for joining
us. Thank you. And I guess we're not going to be here for like 2 months or
something. Yeah, a couple of months, and then we'll be back in the fall with another one of these.
All right, great.
All right, terrific.